This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
This week on Hangar Talk, the FAA says yes to pixels replacing paper.
And we note an increase in female pilots.
Redbird releases a State of the Flight Training Industry report. We'll talk about it.
And Hartzell buys Whirlwind. That's big news.
Finally, a solar eclipse is coming up, David. I don't know if you heard. We'll talk about it from an aviation angle.
All right, Ian, are you ready to do some Hangar Talk?
Let's do it.
From AOPA, your freedom to fly. This is Hangar Talk.
1056, turn right, heading 130, contact final 132.4.
Turn right, sky back.
With your hosts, Ian Twombly and David Tulitz. This is Hangar Talk.
Welcome to Hangar Talk, everybody. I'm Ian Twombly.
And I'm David Tulitz.
David, so in a little bit, we're going to talk to our guest. That's Jason Zilberbrand. Jason is the CEO of VREF.
VREF.
Yeah, hopefully people have heard of them. They're the Aircraft Valuation Service.
Yep.
One of two. Yep. Jason's a cool guy. He's been in aviation a long time. So we'll talk about what VREF is exactly, how they get to their values, which I think people will be interested in, and if there are any deals still to be had out there.
Yeah, I'm really interested in how they come up with the formula that they use to assign pricing. Yeah. I think we all want to know more about that, Ian. Thank you for getting them.
Yep, so we'll chat with him in a few minutes. First, the news. So
yeah,
as we said, the FAA is saying yes to pixels. So the bottom line here is there's a new advisory circular update. Thanks to Bruce Williams for putting this on my radar. So the FAA, as we know, it took them a little while to, I guess, get into EFBs in the GA cockpit, sort of sanction those quasi-officially. There is an AC that basically says you can use them. There's a new update. It's now 9178A that says, yeah, go for it. Basically, everything that's in the cockpit can be digitized, assuming it's a copy of the original, and you're good to go.
Yeah. So, Ian, it looks like back in 2007, the original AC was issued. But now we've got some clarity to the subject. You wrote this story, so you know a little bit more about the details. But I am happy to know that the FAA has finally blessed what so many of us do, which is we use those EFBs. We use an iPad or iPad Mini.
Yeah.
We use Google Androids. We have a lot more information at our fingertips, literally
yes,
at our fingertips now, than when you and I both started flying.
Yeah, than we ever did. I mean, I think we know that we can, you know, use them for charts. I mean, that's been established in plates and things like that. I think what was a little less clear was, could you use them for things like the POH and supplements? Because a lot of us, I mean, we're still carrying those, right? Most people.
Yeah.
So in the AC, they say, and here's, I think, the most important quote. It says, EFBs can electronically store and retrieve information required for flight operations, such as the POH and supplements, minimum equipment lists, weight and balance calculations, aeronautical charts, and terminal procedures.
Well, the weight and balance charts, I think that's a key thing too, because, you know, the ForeFlight app has a really good weight and balance chart mm-hmm. in there if you have one developed for your aircraft.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Garmin Pilot does as well. And there are also other apps, like if you have a Citation Jet, I believe they have their own app, et cetera, Embraer, et cetera. So I think that's super helpful. And it would lead to a little bit better judgment maybe when there's a weight and balance issue.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, so now not only can we use those calculators to be able to arrive at a proper weight and balance calculation, but we can theoretically load up all that weight and balance documentation that we're also required, you know, to carry. And so they do say in the AC, basically, as long as the piece of paper isn't otherwise required by Part 91, specifically in paper form. It said, as long as it's, quote, functionally equivalent to the original paper reference, it's good to go. So, yeah, I mean, this is, I think, fantastic for people moving forward.
All right, so if we're talking also about aeronautical charts and terminal procedures, then that would mean approach plates, right, Ian?
Exactly.
So yep. I can definitely have the blessing of the FAA on my digital approach plate.
Yeah, that's right. So if there's any inspector out there who comes up and says, oh, where's your plate? Where's your chart? Whatever. It's not required. If there's DPE who says to an applicant, oh, I want to see a piece of paper. It's like, nope, sorry.
Well, wait a minute. I'm going to play devil's advocate. Does that mean my iPad mini needs to be charged and turned on and ready for reference? Or what if the battery's dead? Then what do I do?
I mean, I suppose if the battery's dead, they could make the argument that it's like you don't actually have it because there's no possible way to have access. But it's not like there was a rule that said that the paper had to be in your lap, right?
Yeah, it probably had to be in your airplane somewhere, in your chart bag, et cetera.
Right, exactly. Right? So yeah, if it's in the back and, you know, the screen's off or whatever, I suppose that's, that's what you want to do, go for it. But yeah.
Well, let's just let it be a reminder to turn them on, charge them up, and also be careful about the iPads, iPad minis in the sun in some of these cockpits. You know, they could get too hot. So there's some good products that we could use to augment our virtual reality there, looking at pixels versus paper.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, hey, some good news in the student pilot numbers. We know they've been going up the last couple of years. Pilot population's increasing. It's going gangbusters. We know that. AvWeb had a story that got into a little more detail, thanks to some stats that the FAA released, showing that in 2023, there were 69,503 new student pilot certificates, and that's up 13,334 from the previous year. Those are great numbers, David.
That is good. That is good. And the other thing is that the stats were released to coincide with International Women's Day, and it shows an incremental growth in the female pilot ranks. Now, this is something you've written about, Ian. We've talked about it several times, but at least 7,102 women took the first step compared to 5,500 and change back in 2022. So that's up about 1,500 or so. It also revealed that both sexes are taking flying up later in life. This to me was interesting. The average age for all student pilots was up to 35.2 years of age. That's only up slightly, just a tick from 2022. But in 2010, the average age was 31.4 years old.
Yeah.
So almost about 4 years older now. That's interesting. Do you think people have more money, more time, or are just more interested? Or maybe we just do a better job letting people know how great aviation is.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I mean, I wonder, so there's two sort of competing pressures there, I think. One is that I would have assumed that the number was going down, that the age was going down, because I would assume that most of the new people who come into aviation are career folks, right? These are people who see the great news about the availability of airline jobs and what a good paying job it is. And so, you know, they go to an aviation university or, you know, to a local flight school, and they come in early, and that's the beginning of their career, and there they go. And so that's going to be a lower number than previously, right?
Right.
But it's not. And so I'm like, is there some sort of big number of, you know, COVID changed a lot of people's outlook on life. They decided to stop putting off what they had been putting off. You know, they're spending more money on recreation.
Right.
I wonder if that's part of it too.
I think I agree with you on that. I think that it probably is part of it because COVID changed the world. You know, a lot more people did get interested in general aviation during that because, I mean, it just, number one, you couldn't fly commercially for a while. And then with restrictions in different states, different restrictions and all, but commercial travel was down quite a bit while GA travel rose significantly. We wrote a lot about that back then.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So yeah, it is really interesting. One thing that they noted in the story is that ATP, the percentage of pilots who are women who are ATPs is a little bit lower. That's at 5.2. That is up slightly, very slightly. So yeah, I mean, it's overall good news. We wish that stuff would, I think, equalize a little faster. It is really, you gotta love, you know, this is on AvWeb, as we mentioned, and one of my favorite pastimes, as you know, when we talk about these AvWeb stories, is reading the comments.
Looking at the comments. Read the comments. Yes, that is what you love to do.
Yeah, and so not surprisingly, it very quickly turned into a dumpster fire of,
oh boy,
you know, people debating the merits of whether they should even be calling out the fact of how many pilots are women and everything else. And so it's entertaining, I will say.
Well, you know, Ian, one thing that we do a lot here at AOPA, and we've promoted this from various levels. We want more people to get involved in flight training and aviation. And to that extent, we have a whole high school program. The You Can Fly department has a whole high school track. And, you know, that department, the You Can Fly department, and the high schools that we serve for free, FREE, mm-hmm. you know, STEM aviation program, has shown that there could be a dramatic increase in not just female pilots, but in the diversity for aviation overall.
Yeah. Yep.
And it's significant. So yeah. I'm not quoting from exact facts right now, but I do know from talking about this and writing about it a little bit, it's about 45% of the folks at the AOPA Aviation STEM program, and these are youngsters, they're, you know, not grade 9 to 12 students, but about 45% come from diverse backgrounds.
Yeah.
And about 28%, I think, are female, 24 to 28%. So that is higher than what we've seen here
so far
on the reporting that we're talking about today. But that means that there's hope for the future to raise that a little bit higher.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think a lot of that comes from a lot of those programs are in public schools, right?
They are.
They're, you know, available for anybody in that public school. So that's fantastic.
And they're fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I've said it time and time again, I sure wish that I had that available to me when I was in high school. I would not have gone to sleep in class, you know, in some of the science classes. I would not have been chewing gum and throwing spitballs and things like that. But, you know, at least the youngsters now know that there might be an aviation career in their future.
Yes.
And that is the key thing to open the door.
Dave, you're aging yourself there, because now in class it would be using your phone and vaping.
Oh, yeah. No kidding. I'm dating myself big time. You're right about that. I didn't dip anyone's pigtails in inkwell, so I'm not that old.
That's right. Love it. So that actually, it seamlessly transitions into Redbird's State of Flight Training Report, which they put out yearly as part of their conference. And this is really interesting.
Great insight into the flight training world. Good job by Redbird.
It is, yeah. And so this is just a straight survey. This is not like a study or anything else. They just are asking people's opinion. And there is some interesting stuff. They ask about how long it takes to get your certificate, what the cost is, and they look at it from the student perspective and the CFI, the flight school, and the DPE. And a couple of really cool stats that came out of that. One is that, of course, prices have gone up, and that's not surprising.
And so the median cost to earn that certificate increased from 2020, it was $9,000, and in 2023, it's $14,000. So that went up, that jumped up, what, $5,000 in about 3 years. That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a big jump.
That really is a lot. Yeah. Interestingly, though, you know, we always say if you kind of squish your training, right, if you train on a regular basis, so 3 days a week or something like that, that your costs will go down.
Yep.
Well, unfortunately, the time has gone down even as the costs have gone up. So, the median time over that same period. So it used to be 30 weeks to get a private. Now it's down to 24, which is great, actually.
That is. That's six less weeks, man. Yeah. That's pretty good. That's a month and a half less.
Yeah, that is pretty impressive.
It must mean that the cost of renting an aircraft and the cost of an instructor have gone up accordingly.
Yeah. And they do actually talk about what those average hourly rates are. I should say average. It's median.
Uh-huh.
So according to the respondents, the median training aircraft is $175 an hour. An advanced aircraft's $220. Multi's $375. Ouch.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah.
Well, 70% of flight training organizations did raise their prices in the last 12 months.
Yeah. So, that's not surprising. David, you saw in here that, you know, they ask DPEs, too, how they think applicants are doing. And so what caught you?
So this is the DPE's rating of applicants now versus 5 years ago. So are they better? Are they worse? Are they the same? And it surprised me that majority of DPEs say that the applicants are worse or much worse. And the breakdown is worse, 45%, and much worse, 18%. And we add that together, you know, that's like 63%, which is way more than half. And so we got to do a better job here, according to the DPEs. Now, you looked up how many DPEs there are in the country, and they might be overworked. That might be part of the problem.
Yeah, Jason Blair reported on this recently, and he, I think, again, don't quote me on the number, it was somewhere between 800 and 900 total, which has been a pretty consistent number, despite the fact that the pilot, you know, the student number has gone up so much.
Yeah.
So they are squeezed more. I gotta say, I'm not a DPE. I haven't been, so I don't know. I'm not there, so I can't speak to it directly. But doesn't this not just scream to you like, well, when I was younger, students, people knew how to fly airplanes, and today they don't know how to fly airplanes anymore. It just strikes me as a bit like, oh, things are better, you know, the way they used to be is always better. So
the way they used to be, where they were hunting for their paper charts because they didn't have an iPad and digital EFBs and had to have a sectional open
tough,
on
right?
their lap, follow the magenta line, the GPS.
Yeah.
VORs were everywhere, right?
NDB approaches, yeah.
Back course approach. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, that's right. The other thing that got me actually that caught my eye is the last slide here, which I give Redbird credit that they included this because obviously they're a sim manufacturer. They asked about people's impressions of simulation and then they broke it down by the school, CFI, DB, and student. And the bottom line is that most, well, we say schools, CFIs, and DPEs are kind of like meh on simulation. They think it's like middle of the road important. Pilots, students, rated a little bit higher, and prospective pilots much higher.
Right.
Which just shows that maybe we're not meeting the client where their expectations are, which I find interesting.
And it is also interesting that Redbird Flight Simulations, which is a flight sim company, saved that slide for last.
Right. That's how they leave us. Yeah.
But I think that's really interesting, and it does show that students and prospective students do put a lot more weight in flight simulation training. And, you know, Ian, I'm a longtime instrument student. Everyone that listens to this program knows that. And that simulator is super helpful when you're going over that instrument work. So maybe it might not be as good for primary students, but for instrument work and beyond, I find that to be really helpful. Also, I love flying a simulator before I'm going to perhaps a Class B airport or somewhere real challenging.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of benefit to having a flight sim, absolutely, if one's available.
Yeah, you know, Redbird advocated early on when their stuff came out that like they felt like schools could give away time for free on the device and that it would ultimately result in more revenue for the school because people would be coming through faster, they'd get more students because they'd have better success. And I kind of tend to agree with them. I mean, Embry-Riddle did a study a lot of years ago where they took, now these weren't Redbirds, they were Frascas, but they took two groups of students, one sort of quote unquote normal, the control group, you know, and one study group. And the study group, they put them every task in the syllabus, they put them through the simulator first and then the airplane. And almost every single task, I think every task but like one or two, the skills transferred. Basically, they spent less time in the airplane and saved money as a result, even on the private.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, especially when you're trying to learn procedures and you're trying to, you know, get a handle on talking and navigating at the same time or talking and looking at your instruments at the same time.
Yeah.
Just a little bit more practice, a little bit more with the phraseology, I think goes a long way. Honestly, an aviation cockpit, noisy, distractions. It's like my border collie. She's got distractions everywhere, you know. Keeping her on track is really a key thing.
Yeah, right.
And having a simulator is a quieter environment. Mm-hmm. It's one-on-one. You could stop it at any time. And it's proven technology for the airlines, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll be right back. Hey, David, I got a riddle for you. How can you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your airplane?
I think upgrading the pilot would be the first clue for that one.
The guy between the headsets, huh? Yeah.
That's right.
All right. That's not what I'm talking about, but I'll give you a clue. It has ADS-B traffic and weather, Sirius XM weather and entertainment, no wires, and it works with 4Flight and Garmin Pilot.
Oh, Ian, I know what that is. It's the Garmin GDL52 Sirius XM portable weather receiver.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And now, believe it or not, the Garmin GDL52 comes with a 3-month trial of Sirius XM aviation weather and a very special limited time $400 rebate. Learn more about all that this receiver can do and the limited time $400 rebate by visiting sporties.com/GDL52. Okay, hey, let's totally switch gears here. Talk about propellers. So you remember a couple of shows ago, we talked about Hartzell being acquired by Arcline Instrument Management. And now that company has already snapped up a competitor, Whirlwind Propellers, a maker of experimental props based in California.
Yeah, whirlwind propellers are actually, there's one on Mike Felucci's airplane here at Frederick Airport. Mm-hmm. And he has basically a Warbird experimental airplane, an Epsilon, and it's a beautiful prop. It's a carbon fiber with, you know, aluminum edges. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, they are beautiful.
But it makes us wonder, you know, because an investment company bought Hartzell, and now they're looking to maximize the money and the return on investment. It makes me wonder right off the bat if they're going to raise the prices for Whirlwind propellers.
Yes.
And like you said, Whirlwind is known for constant speed and ground adjustable propellers for experimental aircraft, but not just that, for airboats, skydiving wind tunnels, and unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs.
Yeah.
So we need to keep an eye on that. Hartzell did, as you said, raise the price on a typical constant speed prop by about 50% right after that takeover.
Yeah, so that's significant. This obviously surprised a lot of people because Hartzell is in the certified business, so this is their first foray into experimental as far as we know. Also, the fact that it's composite, so they, you know, Hartzell does make composite props. They make metal and composite. Their composites are, it's interesting, they have a different process than MT. So MT, they feel, that is essentially a wood prop with just a composite coat on it, basically. Whereas theirs have a small core and are built up composite props. And so they feel like theirs is a superior product. I don't know how Whirlwinds are built, but I'm not sure that they're buying a technology here. I mean, that would be one angle, right, that they buy the technology. But the other is that they're buying the product line and want to keep it active. They are apparently moving them to Piqua, Ohio, at the Hartzell facility. They're building a new building for them and going to pump them out there. So that is kind of interesting. We'll have to see what happens there. It is a surprising buy, I think.
So they're moving from California to Hartzell headquarters.
Yep, they're moving them.
That's a significant investment. And like you said, Ian, we'll keep an eye on that for the future.
Yeah. All right, hey, let's talk about the eclipse. David, this is your wheelhouse, man. You've been there, done that. So you went to the last major great American eclipse and reported on it for us. So what was that like?
It was really, really interesting, Ian. First of all, let me say to all the pilots that are out here, general aviation airports are a great place to watch the eclipse from. Plan your eclipse viewing so that you're on the ground, you have plenty of time, big wide open spaces. But yeah, indeed, I went to, always mispronounce it, but it's Madras, Oregon, or Mattress, I'm not sure which. But we picked that in 2017 because of the high likelihood of clear skies and maximum eclipse viewing, a maximum totality. It attracted a lot of pilots, but it attracted also, Ian, a lot of non-pilots alike. And as we just spoke a few moments ago about the pilot ranks increasing, this is a great opportunity for folks to understand more about general aviation and what it could offer you. So the eclipse is great. I want to caution folks, definitely do not look at the eclipse straight with your eyes with no vision protection. Go ahead and buy your eclipse sunglasses, even the goofy cardboard and plastic ones. Make sure that they are certified. But a 5-pack of them on Amazon is about 12 or 14 bucks. But don't wait till the last minute for that. And there are plenty of places that Julie Walker wrote about to view the eclipse. But one thing I want to talk about, if you don't mind, is that AOPA partnered up with 4Flight for a really interesting eclipse viewing app. It's not too hard to download it. I did that for my iPad mini, and it shows you the area of totality and how long it'll be semi-dark, and then also shows you the shoulder areas, if you will, the areas that you could go and see a partial eclipse is not quite total.
Oh, that's cool.
It is cool. It actually, and the eclipse goes through, like, how many states, like, what, 10, 20 states?
I mean, right, so it comes across the border in southern Texas and makes a perfect diagonal line all the way up through Maine.
Right.
So, yeah, there's got to be dozens and dozens of airports within the path of totality.
Absolutely. And Julie indicated many, many of these. In fact, I know for a fact she called 430 different airports.
Oh, wow.
And she has a really good list here. Go to AOPA.org and just do a search for eclipse, and you'll find Julie's story. And if you go to AOPA.org/eclipse2024, you could find the instructions for that download pack for 4Flight. Ian, I'm sorry, I don't think there is anything like this for Garmin Pilot unless you know of something like that.
No, I don't.
That's a bummer. but now you're a CFI, and I lean on you a lot of times for things like this. So, you know, a lot of folks have been calling our pilot information center, and you probably know the answer to this. If I'm flying along during the eclipse and it gets totally dark, can I log that time as nighttime?
That's a great question, and it makes me laugh thinking of that question because, and I'm going to tell you why, I'm going to go on a tangent first.
Okay.
And that's because, you know, my son is learning to drive, and we have to log night hours.
Uh-huh.
And so as, you know, a dutiful flight instructor, I go into the MVA book, and I look for a definition of night because it's like, what is night? Is night civil twilight? Is it sunset to the MVA? Is it? They don't care. They're just like night, you know, like use your judgment.
There's no definition like for us, right?
Right. Yeah, we do have a definition. And so obviously an eclipse does not meet the definition of night.
Because it's not civil twilight, right?
Yeah, right. And so no, you cannot log nighttime. But the flip side of that is, of course, you don't have to be night current to fly during the eclipse.
That was my next question, Ian. Do you have to be night current to fly during the eclipse?
You don't. I will say, though, you know, Dave Hirschman was flying during the eclipse because we got that fantastic shot of the air-to-air.
Chris Rose's picture is epic in 2017. And it was a picture of an eclipse
through
the eclipse.
Yeah,
eclipse squared. Jet, right.
And he said the frequency was packed. It was very busy. So I will say, if you're going to fly during that time, just, you know, wouldn't be a bad idea to take your friends along to act as spotters. You know, keep your ears and your eyes peeled because I do think it is going to be quite busy. I mean, we're talking, a lot of the airports are talking about being full already, reservations are done.
Well, they're having crowds and food trucks and events for families and things like that. So it crosses the Texas border. I don't know if we mentioned this yet, at 12:30 Central Time.
Okay.
As you mentioned, that's where it enters from Mexico. And, you know, usually an eclipse lasts about 4 minutes or something like that as it passes over us.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have a whole lot of time if you're going to fly. I do know that Delta is flying a commercial jetliner through the eclipse because a friend of mine, Eric Seals, who works for the Detroit News Free Press, has booked himself a window seat on the Delta jet so he could photograph that for the Detroit newspaper.
Oh, wow.
So it's not just GA people that are getting into this. There's definitely eclipse flights.
Yeah. Well, I heard they had to add a second flight on that because the first one booked in like 10 minutes or something. So, yeah, it is
amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Be careful if you're out there doing the eclipse, but have a great time.
Yep.
And don't forget your eclipse sunglasses if you're looking straight at the eclipse.
Yep.
Also, Nikon and Canon both have photography shooting tips via YouTube. If you're going to do that, also be advised you will need a special lens filter on your camera lens for the eclipse and take some health precautions. Don't stare right at it.
Good tips, David. Thank you. And hey, always a good time to talk about buying and selling airplanes. We love chatting about that. Lots of activity, obviously, over the last couple of years. And so we're going to chat with Jason from VREF just to parse that out a little bit for us. Tell us what's going on with values and where those deals are. Well, Jason, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate you taking the time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So I'm excited to talk about the market. This is something that we talk about often on the show, and obviously all around aviation, we love to, you know, pontificate about what's going on with airplane prices and supply and demand and everything else. So I guess that's the question. How are things going from your vantage point? And yeah, and what's going on right now market-wise?
Yeah, so it's a pretty loaded question, I think. God, the market has been all over the place for, you know, probably the last 4 years. COVID, I think, as you know, really started the acceleration on values, and things went through the roof. And as we like to say, what goes up must eventually come down. There is some natural, you know, organic reasons for that, because there's a natural ceiling to the value of a lot of aircraft. If they hit a certain price threshold, they're all of a sudden competing with another cabin class or other aircraft. And I think the consumer is very smart. They know when to back off, right? And I think that that's really what drives the market, is a willing buyer and a willing seller. And, you know, there's no sense of urgency and there's no sense of stress, and they can come up with, you know, an agreement on price and they close. And I think generally speaking, since COVID, We saw about 18 months, 2 years of insane appreciation, which for those of us who have been around for more than a few years, that's a rarity. Aircraft typically, you know, unless you're talking about older piston aircraft, you know, appreciation on newer aircraft is definitely rare. But we saw everything just kind of go through the roof. And along with that, you know, utilization, chartering, everything went through the roof. You know, I think we went through that, you know, like summer of 69 all over again, when everybody is just like, all right, COVID's over. Let's go travel. Let's go do everything. We don't know if we're going to get another crack at it. We're always worried we're going to get locked back down again. And then I think things kind of eased off, right? We have all of a sudden, you know, moved back to a more normalized market. And what that really means is that inventory levels have come back to a place now where there's more than, you know, 3 172s for sale, right? It was just kind of insane what was going on. So, you know, from my vantage point, the top 5, 10 popular aircraft, they were all below 1% availability. It was unsustainable. The values were going up because people kept losing out on deals. They're like, well, I'm just going to offer the ask, you know, and then the ask kept going up and up and up. And with that, we had, you know, low interest rates. We had a lot of financial institutions willing to lend, and there weren't really a lot of questions being asked about, you know, pedigree. And, you know, I find that a really good market allows really bad aircraft to get sold. And so that's kind of what happened. You know, we saw a bifurcation in the market, really great aircraft for sky high prices and really bad aircraft for sky high prices. And of course, the bad aircraft eventually come back onto the market and it starts that cycle. And over the last 2 years, we've seen the financial institutions back off. Some of that is due to the players in our GA marketplace. Regional banks obviously have had, you know, a tough time, and they're having to put more money in deposit insurance than they have coming in the door. And so they really don't do this consumer lending. And at the same time, the private equity has been purchasing all the consumer loan departments from a bunch of financial institutions and banks. And so it's getting tougher and tougher to get financing, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So interest rates now have really, in my opinion, I think they've just kind of cooled the market off. There's a lot more equipment available. You know, today, a 172 or a 182 market, you know, you're looking probably closer to 3% availability. Which, trust me, that's still phenomenal. It's still a seller's market.
Yeah.
You know, anything under 5% is going to be what we consider a seller's market and a really strong market. So if you think about it, we ran up values about 35 to 40% and we've given about 15 to 20% of it back. So we're still way ahead of the game. If you bought an airplane and you've owned it for more than 5 years, you know, you're in a really good position. If you're getting into the market today, I think the general consumer is kind of sloughed off the high interest rates and the high insurance premiums, and the consumer is obviously driving the economy. You know, I think people are still buying aircraft. It's slower. You know, the winter was slow. Fourth quarter, I think, was really slow. We did see a bunch of transactions end of December. You know, a lot of that was tax stuff, but
sure.
Yeah, I just think, you know, the consumer knows when to sit on the sideline. You know, it's kind of funny, but we all make these decisions every day, and it might not be an aircraft, it might be a car, or it might be a TV, but, you know, we know when there's going to be an opportunity maybe for a discount, or when, you know, there's a lot of questions in the direction of the economy, and it's an election year, you know, we have that really in our face, and I think until that's over with, you know, we're going to see a lot of this, unfortunately, where, you know, maybe the market just stays flat. Maybe we see a little bit depreciation. I think a lot of that's relative, you know, to the aircraft itself and the market. You know, for, you know, the turboprops have been doing great. Utility aircraft have been doing great. AirTractor raised their price like 18% or something from last year, and they still can't get enough aircraft out there. So, yeah, I mean, it's a mixed bag. You know, if you're in the market for a newer piston aircraft, you'll probably be able to get a discount. But there's still a 2-year backlog for brand new, right? So, I mean, it's just kind of crazy.
Yeah. So you kind of alluded to this, and I've heard you say this before, that, you know, we talk about a lot of us who maybe just are sort of analyzing the broader, you know, buyers and sellers market of aviation, we talk about the market as if it's one. But I've heard you mention that it's like, you know, certainly every class, but even every type is its own market. The pilots, it's not just like, you know, it's not cars where it's like the SUV market, right? It's like, no, it's the 172 market or the 182 market or something like that, right?
Yeah. And I think the bigger the fleet, the easier it is to do that. And so I always tell people, you know, buying and selling aircraft, it's truly a popularity contest. So like if you look at the Bonanza market, you've got aircraft for $600,000-$700,000 all the way down to $150,000-$200,000, and you know, F-33As, and they all get lumped together. You know, and personally, I don't think buyers do that. I think if somebody's in the market for an F-33A, they might want eventually to be able to afford an A-36, but they're not going to waste their time looking at something that they A, can't afford, or, you know, and we do that in all of our hobbies. I mean, you know, if you're a golfer, you know, you're going to look at golf clubs that you aspire to own, but you might not have the skill set to be able to buy them. So, you know, the 172, 182 markets are a little bit more complex. Anything that's got a trainer aspect to it, especially the 172, you're competing with a lot of flight schools, you know, pedigree and damage history and condition and maintenance and all that stuff really comes into play. So the good aircraft, unfortunately, yeah, they get snatched up really quick, especially if you try and find like an autopilot and 180 horsepower engine, right? Everything just starts to shrink. So, you know, the pre-owned market's funny because you can't ever check off all the boxes. You're going to have to sacrifice something. Right. So cosmetics are probably the easiest thing to sacrifice, although I find that to be the number one driver in the newer market. Right. It's just it's kind of crazy. So I don't know. Would I want to be buying a 40-year-old business jet right now? Probably not.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just me.
So, OK. So if it's a popularity contest, what markets, what airplanes are losing that contest right now? What's I mean, are there ones that didn't go 40% up? Are there still some deals?
Yeah, there's a lot of aircraft that didn't get run up. Actually, like look at the debonair market. You know, that's a perfect example. Super popular aircraft. They're still reasonably priced, although now that I say that, they are going up in value. But I think that they've kind of been like a hidden gem.
Hmm.
Twins, another still, really, yeah. You know, if you want bang for the buck. Yeah. If, I mean, and I always pick on the twins. Everybody always tells me I'm so anti-twin market. And that's just not the case. It's just... I'm a realist and I've seen what's happened over the last 10 years and with the cost of fuel and the cost of maintenance. And, you know, I get the call from the bank that says, hey, I've got a guy and he's got double overhauls coming up. The plane's worth like 50K and the overhauls are going to be twice what the airplane's worth. You know, what do we do? And I get a lot of those calls. So yeah, the twin market, I think, is one that A, if you got the skill set and B, you've got the appetite, both in terms of insurance premiums and operational costs, that's where you go. I mean, because you're going to be able to get a really phenomenal aircraft for that hasn't gone through the roof, you know, and that definitely correlates to what we've seen in the new deliveries. I think it's the only market that we've seen that really kind of, you know, where the new and the pre-owned are very much one in the same market. You know, without the DA-62, there wouldn't have been any twins delivered last year, really. I mean,
right.
So, yeah, it's a tough one. And I think the single engine... high performance market, you know, has really kicked it in its teeth. It's just, it's hard to, you know, to justify the second engine if you're not gaining it, you know, from a performance standpoint. So, you know, the ones that I think do well are usually the ones that are turnkey, have a non-Frankenstein panel, meaning that it hasn't gone through. Mm-hmm. I mean, like they've just thrown everything, you know, one of everything. It's like going into Caddyshack. I'll take two of these and three of those. And by the time you're done, you're left with a real mess. So, I mean, if you got a clean, modernized panel and it's cosmetically clean and it's not one of these aircraft where you look in the history and see it was bought 2 years ago and it had major damage history. And, you know, there's just a lot of red flags that go up if you do the research. And I think that that's what buyers need to spend more time doing is looking at the chain of title, looking at the ownership history. There's a lot of aircraft out there that I see that are turnkey, beautiful aircraft. You start to look into it and all of a sudden it's like just a Pandora's box. So yeah, I think that's part of the reason why this is so challenging to find a clean airplane that's been modernized, well-maintained, compressions are proper. I mean, like there's a lot of junk that gets put out there. And I think, unfortunately, there is a sucker born every minute. Yeah. And if you know, you've been watching the trend, everything now is like Facebook, social media, a lot less transparency, I think, in that environment, not more. There's a lot more scamming, a lot more just bad juju, I guess, is the feedback I get from people. Now, there are closed groups on Facebook, which I think, you know, if I was in the market to buy an aircraft and the trade of planes and the Barnstormers weren't working for whatever reason, and I don't know why that would be the case, but I would join like a private owners group for an A36, or I would go to the American Bonanza Society and get involved in their forum, because they have a little resale forum too. And I think that that's how you should be doing it. It's a rifle approach. So if you're really interested in a specific model, you know, you're going to have to seek it out. The stuff that's put on the market, and if it's out there for more than 90 days, there's either a problem with the airplane or there's a problem with the asking price. I mean, that's the general rule of thumb. 90 days is kind of like the kiss of death.
Interesting. Okay. So what about overvalued airplanes? So these are ones that, you know, they had their increase like everybody else, but it's like, when you look at capabilities or what's kind of on the market for the price, what do you kind of shake your head at and say, ah, no, it's way overinflated?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely so, and it's funny because it doesn't happen often, but when it does happen, it's usually like a conference call and, you know, I'll have two or three people just be like, how could they possibly have priced it this high? Who's going to buy it? I'll give you a perfect example, not to pick on anybody, because I'm a big fan of the company and I love the airplane. But the new M700 from Piper, I sit back and I go, who's buying this for $4 million with no options? Who? Send them my way. I'd love to talk to them. I want to know what it is that's driving the decision. I think it's a great aircraft, but I think it would have been a really great aircraft at $2.8 million, right? And I think the M600, you know, they sell a ton of them, and now I don't know where that fits.
Yeah,
that's the other question I have. And they're still making it. So it's just the OEMs always want to be bigger. They always want to make bigger aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's a profit-driven decision. I think we can all come to the conclusion that it's very difficult to make money selling, you know, to build an airplane and sell it. My hat's off to them just to go through the paperwork process. It's just a nightmare. And I get it. You know, they don't want to make an airplane and not make anything. But at the same time, I mean, look at the Cirrus market. I mean, look how much a brand new SR-22 turbo costs. You're pushing these people into a different, you know, a completely different cabin class. You know, Meridians aren't out of the realm at that price point, you know?
Right.
So, and that's what I start to see. I see people starting to buy Malibus, and I see people starting to buy, you know, other aircraft because the price point. Look at the 206, the T206H market. Those aircraft are priced so high. I question all the time, you know, is it a cult following? It's got to be.
I wonder, some of those have got to be government, right? Like natural resources and stuff
point.
Like that.
That's a good point. But I mean, if we're just talking about like a high net worth individual.
Right. An individual. Right? Owner,
why would they choose that for 800 grand when, I mean, it's just a high net, right? Yeah. So, but I think that this has been an ongoing problem now. If we go back to early 2000s, the VLJ was all the hype. Everybody was talking about these million-dollar entry-level jets. And then everybody quickly realized, I mean, albeit except for Eclipse, that they just couldn't build it for that number. So it became a $2 million jet, and then a $2.5 million jet, and then a $3 million. And, you know, now you look at the price of an entry-level business jet, and it's $8, $9, $10, $12 million. And you just do reverse engineer the math, you know, $500,000 for the cockpit, you know, $1.5 million aside for each of the engines, the rest of the components, you know, probably another $500,000 and how many hundreds of hours to build it at $110 an hour or whatever the local labor rate is. And you're like, oh my God, they're breaking even. Why would they be doing this? So, I mean, we talked about this a little bit. I mean, I think that's why the OEMs all want to build bigger aircraft, because there's profit margins. But at the same time, I mean, I think it's getting really complicated because the financing is not there. The bigger banks that do lend on newer aircraft, it's not the collateral, it's the creditworthiness. And that in and of itself, I think, it's really going to prevent a lot of aircraft from getting sold. So, have we seen, like, you know, the climax of the new aircraft market? Maybe. Mm. I mean, I think if you break down the gamma numbers, you know, year to year, the business jets were only up 2.8% or something like that. It wasn't very strong. It was basically flat. So, yeah, I think there's a correlation between high interest rate, global economic issues. Don't forget, I mean, outside the United States, everybody seems to be in a recession or borderline in a recession or right. I mean, it's good to be in the U.S., but at the same time, how much can we consume?
Yeah.
And we are
it's a global market, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like 80-85% of the market now is in the United States. There's so much going on that's just going to complicate things. And I think that under our current administration, love it or hate it, I don't want to turn it into a political issue, but there's now a lot more regulation and a lot more focus on our industry. And that too is going to cause people, I think, to take a second, you know. And what I mean by that is, you know, when the IRS starts auditing people that buy aircraft, and when, you know, the Corporate Transparency Act forces you to tell the government who owns what, and then you have to export an aircraft or re-import it if it's owned by a trust because of all of this stuff that went on with, you know, the Wright Brother escrow debacle. Yeah, you start to question, you know, whether or not that this is something that you want to take on. And it also makes it very difficult to find, you know, trusted resources that can handle the complexity of those deals. I mean, importation on its own is difficult. Now that you got this whole extra layer of dealing with the government when you're doing them, yeah, you don't want to just hire anybody. So it's getting more difficult. It's also become, over the last 20 years, very much a fleet operator driven market. You know, when I got into aviation in the early 90s, it truly was corporate aviation. It was, they were called business jets for a reason. They are operated by Johnson Controls and Philip Morris and Aon Insurance and Steelcase and all these phenomenal companies that I grew up, you know, admiring. Today, go find me a corporate flight department. Hmm. There's so few of them left. And most of the new aircraft are being bought up by the, you know, what I call the big three.
The fractionals.
Yeah. Yeah. How many aircraft are really going to high net worth individuals? I mean, look at the global 7,500 market. All of them went to Vista except for one. It's kind of crazy. So I don't know why people are so enamored with the new aircraft numbers, especially in the business jet market, when so few of them are hitting, you know, what I would call like a high net worth individual or even a corporate flight department operation. There's so many aircraft going into these fleet operators. The good news is that the analysts at those operators, they understand, you know, the mechanics and the economics with the cyclical markets that we deal with in aviation. So, I mean, I think that's the good news. They know that, you know, what happened 4 years ago probably won't ever happen again. We've said that before, though, right? We said 2008 wasn't going to happen again, and 99 wasn't going to happen again. So, yeah. I mean, there'll be something. I don't know what it'll be, but I'm hoping, what I'm forecasting is that once the election's over, and I do think the feds are going to lower rates. I just don't think it's going to happen over the summer like everybody's hoping. And once that happens, you are going to be also seeing bonus depreciation reinstated. So I think you're going to see a run on aircraft again. I think everybody's going to do basically, you know, 9 months worth of business in a 30, 45 day period. And then I think all bets are off again. Once interest rates ease, I think you're going to see a lot more lenders, you know, come back into the space. Hopefully what they've been dealing with, you know, is also subsiding. My only concern is the commercial real estate market. It's really hitting these regional banks, which is what, that's like the backbone of GA. I mean, I don't know how many people realize just how lending is done in that market, but yeah, it's very common for your regional bank to do it. So if they don't want the deal or they can't take the deal, there's fewer and fewer participants. And then I think the other thing too is insurance. At some point we have to have a talk about it, right? I mean, the industry has got to fix this problem somehow, some way. I don't think we should be penalized in GA or business aviation for what goes on with commercial aircraft or aerospace for that matter. But we are, you know, and until there is a, you know, some sort of segregation there, I think this is going to just get worse and worse and worse. I mean, I don't know if you own an aircraft, but I mean, the insurance premiums are going up 20% a year. And at what point do you say enough's enough? Right? Or, you know, the family says enough's enough. And I think it sends a bad message to people too, because there's like this underlying emotion when premiums keep going up that you're doing something dangerous and right.
Of course, yeah.
And there's liability.
That it must represent a higher risk, which
exactly.
is not, of course, necessarily the case, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, so it's just like they're killing it. And I think that that's just an unfortunate situation. And I know there's a lot of people that share my opinion, but I mean, I think that we've got a big problem. You know, the demographic for aircraft owners is way up there. I think the average age of, you know, of like from our analytics, it's like 50 plus. To get kids into this industry, I mean, we've got to be approachable, not only from, you know, a price point, but also from an insurance standpoint. We've got to make things a little bit easier, you know, more welcoming. I mean, I'm hoping that some of these new aircraft that are coming to market, you know, because there are a bunch of alternatives. I mean, granted, they're LSAs or experimentals, but I think that that's mm-hmm. why we're seeing such a boom in that segment of the market, is because of the things we just talked about. And so, yeah, for $200,000, you can go buy one hell of an airplane. Actually, there's the Brazilian manufacturer, Montier. I don't know if you've seen their airplane, but they're now based out of Daytona. It's like a 172 type aircraft, but brand new, 200, yeah. $300,000, you know, G3X, the whole nine yards. And there's a lot of that. There's a lot of those types of projects out there, and they've built airplanes. They're selling airplanes. So, I mean, I think that that's really good news. Gamebird is another one, very popular, Epic. They've done a phenomenal job, you know, so there are alternatives. I think that that's kind of where, you know, VREF comes in and assists a lot of the time, unbeknownst to a lot of people. The financial institutions are very gun shy about lending to aircraft that aren't being tracked in the, sure. in the database. So
yeah, they want to market.
Yep. So we go to great lengths to assist new aircraft manufacturers, get them in the database, start tracking, start working with them. And really it's hands-on with the financial community to make sure that they're comfortable. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of new aircraft that are out there. And if you're in the pre-owned market, there's alternatives now, you know, and it comes with a warranty.
Yeah.
No corrosion, yeah, right? right?
Yeah, right. So that's actually a great segue, because I was going to, you know, it's plug time. So tell me, what is VREF for people who don't know?
So VREF is two things. We are one of two authorized value guides for the industry. We track about 800 aircraft. So from experimental LSA all the way through wide body commercial, we're the only group out there that does everything. Helicopters, both fixed and in rotor wing. So you'll find all the piston helicopters, all the turbine helicopters. We do general aircraft. So yeah, we track everything. And then we also are a full service appraisal firm. And so that's a little bit different. So I know a lot of people have like run a VREF report, and that's what we would call like a basic valuation of an aircraft. When you go to borrow money from a bank, they will require what they call a USPAP compliant appraisal. So if you've ever bought a house, it's the same process. The bank will hire us to tell them what the aircraft is worth. So we'll produce 50, 60 page report. And that's what allows the bank to lend on the equipment. The unique perspective we have is that we typically see both the good and the bad before everybody else. And we are seeing some bad news right now, but I don't think any of it's a surprise either. But yeah, all in all, I mean, look, at the end of the day, it's been a crazy, I'd say 8 or 9 months. We've seen just, I mean, along with the weather, the market has been completely off kilter, and it's a leap year on top of it. So go figure. I mean, it's just been completely nuts. and everybody's still around, right? We're still buying and selling airplanes. People are still flying. And I said this when COVID happened, everyone's like, what's going to happen? I'm like, we're not seeing anything negative. We're only seeing positive stuff. And people are like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes things don't make sense. And that's kind of where we're at right now. I think it's going to get very difficult to make, back to what you said earlier, to make a generalized statement about a segment or a class or a cabin. It's almost impossible now. You have to be very specific about what you're talking about, because there are some aircraft still doing phenomenally well, like the Phenom. No pun intended. You know, you can't get one. You can't get a Legacy either. Yeah. Can't get a Praetor. I think, you know, it speaks to how good the aircraft is. And I think it speaks to the price point and the value proposition. Aircraft sell because people find that, you know, it's for the money. You know, you always hear it, bang for the buck. I mean, I don't care what you're buying. You know, that's and I think that that's just the general consumer is never going to really change. You don't go, I mean, it's like you just shop price and you shop features, and whoever's got the best deal wins. And it's because we have so much power in our phone that we're capable of doing all of this research instantaneously. Yeah. You know, things have changed. I mean, we just have to accept the fact that it's not going to be, you know, 1989, and no one's going to have access to this information. It's out there. I mean, people really, you know, and there's no one better to tell you about an airplane than the person who owns it. They're always going to know more about it. So yeah, it's a strange market right now. But overall, I mean, flat's good. And that's kind of what we're dealing with right now, flat for the moment. But we'll see. I mean, I think springtime is always a very productive part of the year, especially for piston aircraft. So sun and fun to Oshkosh. That's like, you know, That's the bread and butter.
Yeah, the sweet spot. I know you, I'm sure you hear this every day, where buyers gripe to you that your prices in VREF are overinflated and sellers are probably griping that they're too low.
Thick skin.
So tell us how the values are arrived at. How do you, you know, the number in the book, it's like, how do you come to that number?
Yes, that's a great question. So, and you are right. I think half the market is always against us. It's just the nature of the beast, but it is empirical data.
Sure.
So when an aircraft gets loaded into the database, whether it's current model year or when the aircraft first is created, the data comes from the OEM. And I think that's really important. We're not pulling numbers out of thin air. So the data set comes from the manufacturer. And then from that point going forward, we track it. And sometimes there's no aircraft sold and the numbers are flat. And sometimes there's a lot of aircraft sold and they're selling for less than our numbers and we have to adjust them downward and vice versa. And we do that by collecting closing numbers. We track every aircraft that goes on and off the market. We do that through machine learning, through an artificial intelligence environment. So we know every airplane that's on controller, trade a plane, you name it. We've got access to it in real time. We're also directly connected to the FAA. We marry those documents. So when we get the closings at the end of the day, we will know if there is an actual sale. And if the aircraft is on the market, then we can match that. And then what typically happens is that either a buyer, a seller, or a bank will report the closing number. And so that's kind of how it works. The healthier the market, the more transactions that are happening, the more accurate we are. And it's not because we want to be, it's just because we live in a world where some fleets have 50 planes.
Sure.
They sell 50 F-150s every minute.
Yeah.
You know, the bigger the fleet, the easier our job is. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Let's take a 182 market, because that's a really good one. They've been in production for how many decades now?
Yeah.
So they're not all going to track the same. But people just say a 182, like I'm supposed to sit there, oh yeah, well, an S and an H, they're the same airplane. They're not. You know, they don't come from the factory the same way.
Yeah.
Now, granted, you could have a 66 182 that is equivalent to a 2007 in terms of equipment. And that's when our database really shines, because if you take the time to input the data properly, you're going to find that the numbers are spot on. I don't think people take enough time. They're in such a rush to get through it. You know, they miss big ticket items. Sometimes they miss deductions. So we've taken out the user, and we're releasing new software here in a few weeks. And for the first time ever, you'll be able to punch tail number in. It's going to find the airplane on the market. It's going to spit out the report. If you want to go in and do it the old-fashioned way like you do it now, you can. But we're going to attempt to take the user out of the whole process so that the credits are,
cool.
Yeah. And I think that that's going to be a game changer. So, you know, our market, I think today is pretty transparent. I think people have access to stuff they never had access to before. And there's a lot of tools out there. And to me, I think you have an advantage, you know.
Well, thanks, Jason. I really appreciate the time very much.
No, thank you.
So I find his advice about twins interesting. I mean, yeah, you can still get deals in twins, but it's kind of like a pay me now, pay me later thing, right? I mean, the reason they're cheaper is because they're so expensive to operate, right?
Yeah. Well, I keep looking and thinking, well, can I get an Apache or something like that, or a twin Comanche? And, you know, you're right. It's pay me later on that. I mean, double the trouble and everything. Yeah. And I don't think that, from what I've heard, they don't glide as good as a single engine.
Yeah.
But the flip side is that you have a second engine to fall back on. So, you know, I don't know, Ian, the jury's out on that. But I'm happy with the Tri-Pacer, and I think you might be happy with the J3.
Yeah, I am happy. Simple is good, right? It reminds me, I remember when I first got into aviation, and, you know, you're a kid, and so you're like, you know, you have these crazy thoughts. And do you remember seeing, like, some of the old jets that you could buy for, like, $25,000, you know, and I thought, whoa, that's amazing.
Yeah, the L-29s, yeah, the Delfin exactly. jet, and the L-39 when it first came to the States was like 30 to 50 grand.
Yeah, yeah, and I remember thinking, whoa, you can get a jet, that's so cool, but it's like, yeah, you could, you know, it's going to be a lawn ornament, like by the, you know, you're never going to be able to actually fly the thing.
$2,000 to $5,000 an hour, I'm guessing, to fly something like that.
Probably.
But man, wouldn't that be cool to fly an old, you know, a military type jet or a trainer jet?
Yeah.
That would be so awesome. Well, speaking of which, cool. we're hoping in the future that we talk to some jet owners that might fly a little bit for pleasure in some of these experimental / exhibition jets. So I would say to our listeners, stay tuned. We might have someone like that in the future.
Very cool. All right. Hey, David, I think that's all the time we have. I'm Ian Twombly. Our editor is Austin Hansen.
And I'm David Tulis. Don't forget, you can find us at aopa.org/hangertalk or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. We'll see you.
See you next time, Ian.
Hangar Talk from AOPA, your freedom to fly.